Chapter 9 Shocks the Conscience. June 26, 2018. Dead asleep at home in New York City, the lead attorney in the ACLU's case against the Trump administration's family separation policy was running on fumes when his phone rang just after 11 at night. Lee Gallant had a right to be exhausted that Tuesday evening. 6 days earlier, the day of President Trump's executive order undoing his own policy he denied existed, the federal judge in the case, Dana Sabraw of the Southern District of California, emerged from more than a month of silence to ask both Gallant and the lawyers defending the Trump administration to answer questions ahead of his ruling on a preliminary injunction that could legally halt separations and force the reunification of separated families. The landscape had changed significantly since the parties last saw Judge Sabraw. Notably, whereas the government had previously denied the existence of a policy or practice of family separations, the Secretary of Homeland Security had by now signed a decision memo instituting the policy, and the Attorney General had announced it. Further, public outrage had reached a boiling point. With thousands of families now separated, the issue had to be addressed urgently. On Friday, June 22nd, after the judge heard oral arguments, during which Gallant told Sabraw he was pleading for him to rule as soon as possible, Sabraw requested supplemental briefings from both the ACLU and the government. By Monday, June 25th, they were submitted to the court, and Gallant was now anxiously awaiting a ruling that would have profound implications for the mental health and well-being of the thousands of children taken from their parents. The phone continued to ring. Gallant opened his eyes, reached for his phone, and answered it. Hello? It was one of his co-counsels calling from the West Coast. We won. Gallant shot up, shook off the fog, and dug into the ruling. As John Mitnick, the general counsel from the Department of Homeland Security, had predicted when he gave his legal analysis of the decision memo presented to Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, the preliminary injunction was granted, mandating the reunifications of separated families on the grounds the separations violated their due process rights under the U.S. Constitution. As Gallant reviewed the 24-page ruling, I was sitting at my computer in my tiny home office off the kitchen. Earlier that day, on a press conference call, Commander White would not tell me nor other reporters that they were still receiving newly separated migrant children despite President Trump's executive order. Bottom line, I wrote at the computer that night, we still don't know the total number of kids separated by zero tolerance, don't know when those still in custody will be reunited, nor where they are. Not until nearly an hour after Gallant was woken by the late-night phone call did I see the news of the ruling. Judge bars separation of immigrants from children. Orders reunification, a Reuters headline read. A federal judge on Tuesday ruled that U.S. immigration agents could no longer separate immigrant parents and children caught crossing the border from Mexico illegally and must work to reunite those families that had been split up in custody, the wire service wrote. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Dana Sabraw in San Diego came in a lawsuit filed over the family separations by the American Civil Liberties Union. The dispatch failed to include the scathing language Judge Sabraw used in his decision. Sabraw characterized the current state of affairs as a chaotic circumstance of the government's own making that has reached a crisis level, resulting in the casual, if not deliberate, separation of families, that the Trump administration had no reunification plan in place was a startling reality. Quoting case law, Judge Sabraw, a George W. Bush appointee, declared that a practice of this sort implemented in this way is likely to be so egregious, so outrageous, that it may fairly be said to shock the contemporary conscience, interferes with rights implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, and is so brutal and offensive that it does not comport with traditional ideas of fair play and decency. The judge ordered the Trump administration to stop systematic separations of children, except in limited circumstances, and to reunite all currently separated children under the age of 5 within 14 days, and all others within 30 days. He ordered Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Protection, the Bureau of Prisons, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, all of the agencies involved in this man-made disaster, to work together in order to undo it. And perhaps most important, he ordered a stop to deportations of parents without separated children, hundreds of which had already occurred. The judge's countdown had begun, and in detention, children and parents were still clueless about what was happening to them. June 28, 2018. Around 48 hours later, I got a phone call from Lindsay Tislowski, the lawyer who had been attempting to make contact with incarcerated migrant fathers who had been separated. Despite all her work on behalf of separated families, Tislowski, executive director of Immigrant Defenders Law Center, had only caught my attention a day earlier. In an article in the Texas Tribune, she described the extraordinary and heartbreaking experience of standing before an immigration court with her client, a toddler separated from parents. "We were representing a 3-year-old in court recently who had been separated from the parents," she said. "And the child, in the middle of the hearing, started climbing up on the table. Again, I thought of my son, not quite 3, but a table climber nevertheless. The idea of him being anywhere alone and made to fend for himself made me sick." I had been borderline harassing Tislowski, having showed up unannounced at her office in an Art Deco building in downtown Los Angeles that dated to the 20s, to try to speak with her. I rode the elevator to her floor to try to ask her about the tiny children she was coming across and how Judge Sabraw's order would affect her work on their behalf. Her colleagues politely told me to go away, which I did, and Tislowski called me back that night. When she did, I pulled out the little blue spiral notebook that I had been holding close since touring Casa Padre. She explained to me she had occasionally seen separations before Zero Tolerance when she was working for Catholic Charities, but the rate of the separations had spiked, by now a surprise to no one. Her firm had a contract to offer legal services to children detained in shelters run by ORR in Southern California. Tislowski and I talked about the 3-year-old, who she said wasn't alone in being hysterical and hungry. She was seeing parents deported almost immediately after separations. But to my surprise, what she wanted to talk about wasn't children at all. It was separated parents who were being denied the right to an attorney. She told me about Victorville and the hundreds of migrants, including separated fathers, who were in both the federal prison and the immigration detention center not far away in Adelanto. I had never heard of Adelanto, one of the largest immigration detention facilities in the United States. There, without attorneys, she told me that parents were making decisions not to fight for asylum claims, influenced by the government telling them the quickest way to reunite with their children was to be deported with them. If they did have counsel, they could go through with their asylum claim, she told me. I asked her what the judge's ruling meant for these parents. They'll now be able to get a screening for credible fear, an important step in receiving asylum. Until now, everyone has been told nothing about next steps, she said. I told her I would be interested in joining her on a trip to the high desert to meet the separated parents she was trying to help, if she was willing. We agreed to speak again, and I wished her good luck. The next day, June 29th, the emergency management staff, working furiously to reunite separated families, made their way into the headquarters of the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C. Those working in the Secretary's Operations Center, SOC, would enter when it was dark, spend the day in a windowless room, and often emerge again in darkness. On this Saturday, protesters were streaming down Pennsylvania Avenue, a few blocks away, and in hundreds of other cities nationwide, united under the banner Families Belong Together. Inside the SOC, they were doing the very work that the protesters were demanding as they marched toward the White House in scorching heat and heavy humidity. "These children may never get back to their parents," Commander White was known to say. "If they do, it will be because of you. There is no plan B." After Judge Subraw's ruling, those hoping to get parents and children back together allowed themselves to crack a smile. They now had backup from the federal courts. While the protests kept the pressure on President Trump, who tweeted that day in response to the nationwide protests, it couldn't speed up the reunification efforts. Thousands of parents and children waited for the relief so many Americans were hoping they would get. July 6, 2018. So urgent was the mission to reunite the thousands of children in the custody of the federal government with their parents that every few days the parties, the ACLU and the Trump administration, would reconvene to update the judge on the government's progress. It wasn't looking good. 4 days before all of the children under 5 years old were to be reunited with their parents, on a Friday afternoon in California, the Trump administration still couldn't say for sure how many kids it had separated, nor where all their parents were. I know there was some number that were, at one point, were remained in Marshal Service custody, Trump administration lawyer Sarah Fabian told the judge about separated parents. I don't have that number for you. If that is part of this, 46 are in ICE custody, 19 have been removed from the country, and 19 were released from custody. I'm not sure if that math adds up without my phone. If what she was saying sounds to you like a complete and total disaster, it's because it was. Shoddy record-keeping, poor planning, and a scramble to fix everything made for an unbearably complex situation. But it was one that the ACLU continued to insist was not insurmountable, and one that could be resolved with time and dedicated attention. The vetting process itself was the most critical issue the government and the ACLU had to agree on. Gallant argued for an expedited process, emphasizing the urgency of reuniting families. Subraw seemed to buy the argument, and the government indicated they would likely not fight back. I would be prepared to indicate that the ORR-HHS should not feel obligated to comply with those internal procedures because this case is so different. It involves separation of minor children from parents. That evening, he ordered the government and ACLU to meet and confer on the ORR policies and procedures in dispute and to submit a plan to streamline the process. By Monday, they had still not agreed on the streamlined process for even the less complicated cases. Further, the number of children slated to be reunified by the Tuesday deadline wasn't anywhere near the total number of separated children under five. In other words, the Trump administration was going to miss the deadline the judge set to get toddlers back together with their parents. Part of the problem, as had been suspected all along, is that some of the parents had been deported. Gallant interjected, "We think there are at least 12 parents who have been removed, i.e. deported, and 9 have been released into the interior." It was with this level of granularity that the reunification process had to be dissected in court, every child a soul experiencing added trauma with each passing hour. Further complicating reunifications was the fact that some parents were classified as having a criminal conviction or communicable diseases, two categories exempted from reunification under the judge's order. On Tuesday, the deadline to reunite 103 children under five came and went, and only a fraction of the children were successfully reunited with their parents. 2 days later, the government admitted it had only been able to reunite 57. The rest, they said, were either deported, locked up, or ineligible to be reunited for reasons including having a communicable disease or criminal history. The following day, a Friday, the government and ACLU together submitted a status report. On behalf of the Trump administration, Chris Meekins, the chief of staff to the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within HHS, argued against the streamlined unification process, on the grounds that placing an unaccompanied minor with a sponsor would potentially harm children. "My opinion," he wrote, "is that complying with the court's orders involves increased risks to child welfare in at least four respects. They were, one, placing children with adults who were not parents, two, placing children with an abusive parent, three, placing children with an abusive person living in the same home, and four, placing children in a home with an alternative caregiver in the case that a parent has already been deported." The court's necessary truncating of the vetting process, Meekins argued, materially increases the risk of harm to children. Judge Sabraw excoriated the filing. I have some very serious concerns about the filing and, frankly speaking, am very disappointed. He continued, saying it was wholly inadequate. The declaration is also clearly written to provide cover for HHS. That's all it is doing. It is explaining a parade of horribles about how under a streamlined process, there is a 6.86% chance that something's going to happen. That is not going to happen. There needs to be a complete readjustment in HHS with how they are going to go about this, Sabraw later concluded. In an order issued after the hearing, Judge Sabraw wrote, "It is clear from Mr. Meekins' declaration that HHS either does not understand the court's orders or is acting in defiance of them. At a minimum, it appears he is attempting to provide cover to defendants for their own conduct in the practice of family separation and the lack of foresight and infrastructure necessary to remedy the harms caused by that practice." Not pulling any punches, Judge Sabraw insisted in his order that the Trump administration shall have a representative from HHS personally appear in his courtroom on Monday morning. All the while, efforts to reunify separated parents and children continued into and through the weekend. July 9, 2018. Under Judge Sabraw's orders, no separated parent was to be deported without having been reunited with their child or children. That is, quote, "unless the class member affirmatively, knowingly, and voluntarily declines to be reunited with the child prior to the class member's deportation." Just shy of 1 month locked up in Adelanto, the immigration detention center in the high desert above Los Angeles, Juan was presented with a form in English that contained those exact same words. The separated parents removal form was given to him in a language he didn't understand, despite the fact that when he was apprehended, it was noted he did not speak English. Now he was presented with two options, neither of which, as lawyer Lindsay Tislowski had warned me, said anything about a right to pursue an asylum claim. English. "I am requesting to reunite with my children for the purpose of repatriation to my country of citizenship. Signature / firma." English. "I am affirmatively, knowingly, and voluntarily requesting to return to my country of citizenship without my minor children, who I understand will remain in the United States to pursue available claims of relief. Signature / firma." He signed the second option. 4 days later, he signed the same form in Spanish, told by an official inside the detention center he had to because he had signed it already in English. Just as he was pressured to sign forms while he was at the Border Patrol station in Yuma, Juan was unclear about what he was being asked to do. He didn't understand the consequences of his actions. Intimidated and alone, his only hope would be legal representation that could undo what he had inadvertently done. Telling the United States government he wanted to be deported without his son, who was taken from him when they arrived together. In the meantime, he was stuck in Adelanto. Less than 2 months earlier, the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security had conducted a surprise inspection. What they found were conditions suitable for no human being. Nooses in detainee cells. Migrants improperly subjugated to solitary confinement. And poor quality medical care. The Inspector General noted then, in a report to be released later, that, quote, "in about 15 of the approximately 20 male detainee cells we visited within four housing units on the west side, we observed braided bedsheets referred to as nooses by center staff and detainees hanging from vents. The contract guard escorting us during our first visit removed the first noose found in a detainee cell, but stopped after realizing many cells we visited had nooses hanging from the vents. We also heard the guard telling some detainees to take the sheets down. One detainee told us," the OIG continued, "I've seen a few attempted suicides using the braided sheets by the vents, and then the guards laugh at them and call them suicide failures once they're back from medical." This was Juan's home for the foreseeable future. July 15, 2018. One by one, their names were called. 37 separated children were told they would need to pack up and get ready to hop in waiting vans. They would be taken from the Harlingen Shelter for Migrant Children, operated by BCFS Health and Human Services, to the Port Isabel Detention Center run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, where they would be reunified with their parents. The shelter had twice confirmed by phone with ICE they would soon be en route with the children. It was all part of the plan, if you could call it that, laid out in court by the Trump administration. If the 37 were anything like Jose, who had been in the custody of the shelter for a month, with so little exposure to the outside world he didn't even know what the shelter's full exterior looked like, having their names called was a massive relief. After lunch, as they filed out to the passenger vans, hundreds of fellow migrant children were left behind in the shelter. Jose was one of them, his father nowhere near Port Isabel. Juan was still locked away at another ICE detention center, Adelanto, 1,600 miles away. Jose would go about his Sunday like he did the previous four. He was not classified as tender-aged, 5 to 12 years old, and thus he was over the cutoff age for children who would get to see their parents. As the younger children pulled out of the facility, the second largest in South Texas behind the Casa Padre shelter, which housed more than 500 children, they headed toward Los Fresnos, turning left onto East Harrison Avenue. Had they turned right, they would have seen the city they had been near but never visited during their detention. Just beyond the shelter was the Harlingen soccer complex, which had been off-limits to them. After likely crossing a yellow vertical lift bridge dating to 1953 that stretches over the Arroyo Colorado, they'd pass through the small city of Rio Hondo. From there, it would be just over 20 minutes until they pulled into the detention center. As the crow flies, they were not far from where the Rio Grande meets the Gulf of Mexico, where I thought in April my journey along the border would end. For these 37 children, the hope they would soon see, speak with, and touch their parents for the first time in too long must have filled their heads. But as they pulled into the parking lot outside the detention center, that hope withered. The vans began idling in the parking lot at 2:30 in the afternoon as staff from the Harlingen shelter brought the children into the ICE facility designed to detain adults only. The shelter staff was told paperwork to secure the release of the parents in order to reunify them wasn't yet complete, so the kids packed up and headed back to the vans in the parking lot where they waited. And waited. And waited. Shelter staff called back to colleagues in Harlingen to ask for more vans to allow the children to stretch out within them and to have food to eat. As day turned to night, the staff again attempted to jumpstart reunifications by bringing the children back inside, but many of the kids were too cold to sit inside the air-conditioned facility and so went back to the vans, where they could rest more comfortably. As Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials inside the facility clocked out and went home for the day, Andrew Carter, the regional director for BCFS, wrote to his boss, Kevin Dinnan, the company's CEO, explaining what had happened. "It is 22:30 and they are still in the vans and not one of our children has been checked in. In addition, there are other vans with kids from other facilities that are waiting as well. There has to be a better process. I hope as we move forward there can be adjustments so we don't put tender-age kids in this position. If coordinated properly, we can be scheduled for a particular intake time so there are not multiple programs arriving at the same time and overwhelming the intake process at the facility. Any attention you can provide or elevate regarding this issue is appreciated." Dinnan forwarded the email to his chief operating officer, who almost immediately forwarded it to Commander Jonathan White, the man in charge of the reunification effort who had been holed up in the Washington, D.C. bunker from which he was managing the process. They had sent it to the right guy. Earlier that day, Stephen Wagner, the acting assistant secretary at HHS at the Administration for Children and Families, and his direct report, Scott Lloyd, the head of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, had received a stern email from Dr. Robert Cadlick, the assistant secretary in charge of the team managing the emergency response that was the reunification process. "Steve and Scott, in light of the last 36 hours, I am asking that tasking and accountability of ORR personnel involved in reunification operations be given to Don Boyce, my overall operational manager, and Jonathan White, the federal health coordinating official, for this response. This request is to ensure the most expeditious management and coordination of what would be ordinarily a difficult mission that, as a result of delays and confusion of the last 12 hours, is now almost impossible. Clear command and control relationships are vital to accelerate what we are doing. Those two Trump-appointed men, one of whom, Lloyd, had personally supported the destruction of the unofficial list tracking family separations in April, were now officially sidelined, removed from any responsibility having to do with reunifications. Commander White, who had been copied on that email, wrote back to the BCFS leadership the following morning, weighing in. "You did the right thing," he said. "I am in travel to testify about this mission in court. Thank you." It was Commander White whom the government had selected to represent Health and Human Services in the San Diego courtroom of Judge Dana Sabraw, who had grown furious with White's colleague Chris Meekins. White had some cleaning up to do. What White didn't say at the time was that, unlike Meekins, he was looking to use streamlined processes in order to get children reunited as quickly as possible. "This will be chaotic," he told colleagues. "We tolerate chaos and disruption so long as no child is unsafe." It was White who had given the go-ahead for the BCFS vans to make their way to Port Isabel, knowing that the facility was likely not ready to reunite at the time, but that children waiting outside would force the issue. As White walked into court wearing the dark blue dress uniform to outline the government's new plan, 17 of the 37 children had been reunified at Port Isabel, but 20 continued to sit in the vans. At the start of the hearing, Judge Sabraw ordered the government to stop deporting reunited parents and children together. "If space is an issue, the government will have to make space," Sabraw said. He then turned to Commander White, who had been summoned to explain both the government's new plan for reuniting families and what he called the exasperating declaration from Chris Meekins on Friday. White explained the reunification process he had devised. "Once a parent has been cleared for reunification, that is the green light to ORR to initiate ORR's administrative process and travel process to move the child. It is my planning factor that from that moment, depending on the geographic proximity of the child, anywhere from 6 to 48 hours later, the child will be there at the ICE facility for physical reunification," White explained. After a quick break, Lee Gelernt, the ACLU's lawyer, asked Commander White about the status of reunifications. "Thank you, Commander, for being here," he began. "Have the reunifications for children 5 and above already started? Not the process, but have there been actual reunifications?" "Yes, sir," said Commander White. After a back and forth about the current number of separated children, now officially 2,551, Gelernt returned to questions about the reunification process. "There has been some concern that reunifications occurred at night for the children under 5. Will reunifications occur late at night for the children 5 to 17, as far as you know?" "Some will occur at night," Commander White said. "It has been operationally necessary for us to ask ICE to extend its hours," he explained. "We understand our operational direction to be to expedite reunification of children, and that's what we're doing." White did not mention that was exactly what was happening as they spoke at Port Isabel. Judge Sabraw, who days earlier was apoplectic at HHS and Chris Meekins, struck an entirely different tune with Commander White. "The observation I would make is that Commander White is exactly the person that is needed, and I'm very appreciative that you are here, the way you have explained this process. There is no question that you understand the context of this case, the undisputed facts that have led to this difficult situation," the judge surmised. "The responsibility of the government and HHS to make it right through reunification in a safe and efficient manner. I have every confidence you are the right person to do this. When I hear your testimony and I look at the plan, it provides a great deal of comfort." What else Commander White did not reveal that morning in court is that he had been trying to stop the family separation policy from happening all along. He and his colleagues within HHS had been sounding the alarm from the earliest days of the administration for nearly 2 years about the damage that the process would do to children. The problem was compounded by the fact that the agencies were not prepared to track and reunite families once the policy started. Indeed, there was no plan in place, which is exactly what Commander White was undoing on a daily basis, creating one. When the hearing ended in San Diego, it was just around lunchtime at Port Isabel, almost a full day after the vans pulled into Port Isabel from Harlingen with the 37 children on board, 32 of them had been reunified. Not until almost 6 in the morning on Tuesday in South Texas was the last child finally reunited, 39 hours after first arriving in the parking lot. White's system was imperfect, but it was getting the job done. The next day, Jose's case manager at the same Harlingen shelter sent notice to ICE that he was ready to be released to his father. ORR has determined that the below juvenile respondent should be released to a sponsor, the form read. The director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, Department of Health and Human Services, requests that the Chief Counsel, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Department of Homeland Security, notify the Executive Office of Immigration Review of the change of address. The address listed was the Adelanto ICE Detention Center where Juan, Jose's dad, was locked up waiting to see his son. And their waiting would not end anytime soon. From National Immigrant Justice Center to Salvano Dunn, Dana, CC, CRCL Compliance. Subject, urgent. Two children transferred to adult ICE facilities where their parents are not in custody. Date, Tuesday, July 24th, 2018, 6:04:08 p.m. Dear Officer Salvano Dunn, thank you for your time at the stakeholder engagement this evening and for your willingness to assist in cases of urgently arising rights violation in the context of DHS and HHS's family reunification process. I am sending this complaint and request for help with regard to two NIJC child clients. In both cases, the children's attorney of record learned this morning via a manifest provided by the ORR shelter that the children would be transferred from ORR custody in Chicago to DHS custody at the Port Isabel Detention Center, PIDC, today for the purpose of reunification with their fathers. We believe both boys are either at or soon arrive at PIDC. In both cases, it is our understanding, verified by the ICE online detainee locator, that the fathers are not at PIDC, but are instead in DHS custody at the El Paso Processing Center. Information regarding both families is below. Our request for remedy in both cases is for DHS to immediately transfer the fathers to PIDC for reunification and release with their sons.